Welcome to Making Conversation, a podcast where we celebrate making in all its forms. From amazing stories of inspiring makers and people to behind-the-scene peaks of Building Bright Collective, our monthly crafty membership for all things art and craft, and the Making App, the first social marketplace for makers. We believe that the simple act of making can transform your life and in turn change our world. This is why making exists. I'm your host, Ashley Yowsling. Have you ever stopped to think about what is art? What is craft? Are they the same thing? I dive into this discussion with our guest today, Emily Nicolaides. Emily is a fascinating artist and author of a brand new book, Amazing Circular Weaving. Emily studied art history and anticipated a life in the traditional art world, but found herself paving her own path, creating a beautiful world of weaving, and now living on the island of Cyprus. So find your latest project and have a listen. I hope you enjoy it as much as I have. You can find Emily at emilynicolaides.com and on the Making App and Instagram at emilynicolaides. And with that, here's Emily.
So I first began making as a child. It was something that was always kind of in the background, and particularly fiber art. That's something that was passed down to me from my grandmothers. My maternal grandmother taught me how to crochet and braid and use a sewing machine. And she was from Roanoke, Virginia. And then my paternal grandmother taught me how to knit, and then also introduced me to lace making and embroidery. And she is from Cyprus, where I live now. And so I'm half Cypriot, half American. And I always felt a bit of a disconnect between my two cultures. And at some point during college, I went to school for studio art and art history. I began to like connect these pieces and remember what my grandmothers had passed down to me. And I realized at some point, it was like, it just hit me that although my grandmothers didn't speak the same language, they both had the same language of fiber art. And that sent me on a journey and to this moment where I've been weaving exclusively for the past 10 years. But yeah, I probably wouldn't be doing fiber art without my grandmothers.
Tell me a little bit about how you ended up in Cyprus.
So I have always wanted to live here. I grew up visiting when we could, coming and visiting my family here. Pretty much half of my family has stayed in Cyprus. And so it was always really fun to visit. And I knew I wanted to live here at some point. And it was never the right timing until suddenly it was. An opportunity came up to move in 2021. And so with the pandemic and everything, it was just the right timing. My husband and I could work online, and I was already teaching online, and we were both ready for a change. And so within about 3 months, we had packed up our house. I had packed up my studio, sold my car, and we got on a plane with four suitcases and moved to Cyprus. And we've been here since then.
That's amazing. So tell me a little bit about your location, what it's like living on, you know, is Cyprus considered an island?
Yeah. So it's so different. So before I was in Cyprus, I was in Richmond, Virginia. Virginia has always been home base for me. I've moved a lot and I always end up back there, but it's quite a different lifestyle to live on an island. And we live in a medium-sized city here, so there's a lot going on. And it's called Limassol. We're on the southern coast of the island, and so the beach is like 10 minutes away. The mountains are about 30, and that is like one of my favorite parts about being here is how close to nature we are. And it's such a quick trip to go swimming, to go hiking. And I really enjoy having everything so close. And at the same time, it's like if you want to like go on a road trip, the farthest I've been on a road trip here is like maybe 3 hours. So that's pretty different. I was in the US a few weeks ago, promoting my new book, and I like drove up and down the East Coast, and I had forgotten what it was like to drive for 8 hours. And, yeah, so that's pretty different. Very, very small, but, there's a lot going on here when it comes to art and culture, and it's all very different. And, I'm just enjoying the experience of actually living here, because the things that I would pick up on when I was growing up and coming to visit for a few weeks, I'm just getting to know my culture in a whole new way. Now that I'm here full time, I mean, I can't tell you how many holidays I didn't know were holidays until I woke up and went to the studio and somebody told me it was nobody's working today. It's a holiday. So
how do you feel like your culture has influenced your making? I mean, obviously you're living there now and discovering that in a whole new way, but you know, your grandmother also being from Cyprus, like I'm sure as an adult, you can reflect back and see ways that it somehow, pardon my pun, wove its way into your story earlier on too.
Yeah. I have always, personal history has been a big thing that I'm thankful that I've learned about from my family and understanding where we come from on both sides, on the Cypriot side and on the American side. And understanding our roots, and that's given me an appreciation of history in general. And I mentioned this before, but I have a bachelor's degree in art history, and that was something I really enjoyed, and I didn't really know if I would ever do anything with it. But I did have some understanding that having that context for what I was making was important. And so looking back, I think that that has had a really big role in my work as an artist and understanding what I make is a part of a greater lineage and history. And so, okay, maybe it's indirectly a part of my culture, but it's all played together. Even understanding down to the techniques that I use, where are those originating from? And now that I'm here in Cyprus, I'm also starting to learn more about traditional Cypriot fiber art techniques. And in weaving specifically, I took a workshop a couple months ago in a traditional style of Cypriot weaving called Fithkiotiko. And it's from a very specific village in the Paphos region called Fiti. And people have been doing the same style, working with the same pattern since the Middle Ages. And that is just so cool. Like that lights me up to know that like these things that I'm learning, like people have been weaving them the same exact way, or, you know, they've been developing, but it's the same thing that like so many generations have been working with. And I, as a weaver and as someone who's done a lot of teaching, I really try to impart that to my students as well, to understand that, all right, this is not just like a fun thing that we came across on Pinterest. Maybe that's our entry point into this. But when you sit down to weave, doesn't matter how complicated or how simplistic, you get to engage in this history and be a part of the lineage of weavers that's gone on for thousands of years. And that's a really special thing and not something to be overlooked. And,
I love that. So taking a step back, what did your making practice look like and how did it evolve like as you grew up?
So I didn't really do art in a very serious way until college. I took some like graphic design in high school, but that was about it, other than like the art classes that everyone else was taking in elementary and middle school. But it was something in, you know, the times I had downtime, I was playing with materials. I was interested. And specifically, I remember spending a lot of time making like hand stitching little pillows. I knew how to use a sewing machine, but just did not find that as satisfying as like hand stitching. So I used to make these like, I would go to the to the fabric store and get the little dollar swatches and like just make these little pillows. And yeah, they didn't, you know, they didn't have any like real purpose or meaning. I would make them and like toss them. But it was something that I just found really relaxing and really satisfying and something I could do alone and in like quiet after a day at school or whatever. And I didn't really take any of that seriously. And again, like that was something that I had learned from my grandmothers, and I didn't even equate it with art until later on when I ended up, when I honestly fell into studying art in college. I had other plans and had to take some preliminary art courses as a part of something else I thought I would do. And I really enjoyed it and I was good at it. And so I just kind of kept going with art and spent a lot of time doing ceramics and sculpture. And again, it was like, I just found it satisfying in a way that I didn't get in other mediums. And anyway, ceramics wasn't for me, but that was my introduction to craft, which led to weaving. And then it was like, really, like I had a moment. I was in one of my last art history classes was women's art history, which is, you know, we had one class on that and like a whole degree program, which is another topic. But we did look at fiber art in there, and I started to realize like, wow, like specifically we were learning about the G's Bend quilters and the incredible things that have happened for them. And, you know, their work is in the MoMA now, these quilts made of scraps. And that's when it really started to click, like, oh, these things my grandmothers have taught me, this can be art. This is not some other like separate lowly thing. This is something to be celebrated. And that is when I really started to shift my thinking around that and became interested in fiber art in a much more serious way.
There's this idea that art and craft are separate. And I've been exploring that conversation with other guests where I don't really actually see a separation. And I think what has caused the separation is these systems that have come in and placed value on one thing over another, or certain people over another. Without getting too deep into that, I think that, you know, being an art history major and then your profession now being in craft, I'm curious, like, what your thoughts are on that. Like, this is something that I talk a lot about, but I love hearing other people's thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, from the beginning, it's a flawed system. On an institutional level, there's a reason why art and craft are separate, why there are so many more white male artists than any other kind of artist. And there's so much there we could talk about. But in my experience with studying art history, I mean, the first issue that I think is important to break down is that in art history, it's divided into Western and non-Western art. And when you take any intro-level art history class, it's usually two semesters, and it's focused on Western art. And that just means art that's from Europe, really, which is only accounting for the most part white artists. And I mean, in my degree program, I'm really thankful for all of the professors that I had, and I had a really great experience, and it's not necessarily their fault. It's just the way these things go. But like 75% of my classes were Western, and very small percentage were non-Western. Actually, most of the non-Western classes I taught were optional, or that I took were optional. And yeah, so non-Western basically refers to like anything that's not North American or European. And a lot of the textile art that you see comes from the non-Western classes, like looking at African art or South American or Asian, like to speak very broadly. That's where you're seeing the fiber art, and I mean also ceramics and woodworking, the things that are traditionally labeled as craft. And then, you know, most of what you study is their paintings in the Western classes. It's all paintings, and that's exciting to a point. There's like so much to look at there, but it really discounts all of the other amazing things that humans have made and created throughout history. Yeah. That's the brief version.
Yeah. No, I want to dig into this a little bit because we have some time, and the conversations that I've had about this thus far have been with artists and not people who necessarily studied art from like a historical perspective or traversed like kind of both art and craft, if you will. Because of these structures or systems that were created that really focused on Western art and white male painters, if you will, I can't help but feel as though that really created a barrier to entry for everyone else, if just through thought or belief that you could, you know, if you weren't a white male during that time. And when I look at how that has changed over the years, you know, there's so many artists now, you know, you go on any social media platform and there's just this influx of every kind of person and art, but the art that is, you know, kind of put on this pedestal and sells for millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars is still, and is referenced in history books, even though this might be changing just a little bit for more modern history, it's still these older Western artists. And it's not that that art is not great or shouldn't be respected, but the thing that I think a lot about these days is that accessibility kind of aspect. And of course, in a very like modern sense, we're thinking about that because of how it plays out in, you know, 2022, 2023, in that, you know, when you're creating an app or you're creating a product or whatever, you want everyone to feel welcome, but you also want everyone to feel empowered, right? Like you want everyone to feel like they could go buy a box of paints or buy yarn or whatever and have the same, you know, access to these things. And so I'm curious, you know, just diving into kind of a little tangential part of this is just how over time through what you've studied, but also like being in different countries and being in even Cyprus now, like how you see that accessibility, that access part of it playing out.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of work to like break those precedents that are set and seemingly set in stone. And you also have to look at like who's making these decisions, who are the collectors spending the millions on artwork, and who are the people who are valuing their artwork at that level. It's mostly white people, white males. So it's like from the top, it's like when we have more diversity at the top of the people who are making these decisions, then we are from the beginning having more representation throughout everything else. And, you know, whether that's art sales, art collection, representation, education, because the artists are there, like you're saying, like the artists are there, like And now more than ever, because of the internet technology, we can see that the artists are there. And that doesn't mean that the algorithms that are at play that are helping to promote people are representing people equally. But we have, at least we can see now more than ever that that diversity is here. And, you know, it's how do we, like, how do we create systems that are more equitable in how artwork is promoted and valued? So big problem to solve. Yeah.
100%. And the other part is, like, I don't know, I'm kind of bullish that, like, we can change part of this. I do really believe that in so many different people and so many different ways, we can break apart some of these strongholds that have been around for time immemorial. And sometimes that's literally, I believe, just through decentralizing, like, the power, you know, when you look at art and making. So
yeah, absolutely.
You know, making an app for makers, while small-ish right now, I think about how that is part of taking power. That's part of breaking up the structure of, you know, these monoliths that exist right now and are run by algorithm and only benefit certain types of people. So I want to hone in on the value aspect a little bit. You know, there's this beautiful podcast with Heidi Zuckerman. She's a CEO of an art gallery in California and has created other galleries from the ground up. And she's got a great podcast on the Rich Roll podcast. And she talks all about art, and she very much comes from this art world. And so one of the things that she says is that anyone who is a person can create something and call it art. And we get, as the artist, get to decide if it's art or not. But other people, they're not allowed to say whether it's art or not, but they are allowed to say whether they like it or not. Like, they can have an opinion about it, but it's up to the, you know, creator, the beholder, that if it's art. And, you know, this idea of what has value, holds value, I think this is a metaphor for all things in life and how we value many things, not just art or craft or whatever. But there very much is this belief that craft, whether it's the materials used or the technique used or the ability that you can create multiples of it, that craft, it has less value. And of course, this could be challenged, but if you were to create 20 circular weavings versus one and create exclusivity around it and create it as, you know, traditional art, this is still part of that structure system of, like, what is value? Like, value is kind of the crux of how people are defining what is art and what is not, like assigning a value to something and determining it by XYZ. And so I'm curious, do you consider what you do art? And how do you unpack that value idea?
Yeah, you're bringing up a lot of interesting points here. I do consider what I make art for the most part. I mean, depending on the context of what I'm making and the purpose of it. But for the most part, I would say, yeah, I make art. There is something, I haven't made a lot of multiples of the same thing. I've done a lot of things in the same technique and same style, but as far as like replicating the same thing over and over again, I don't have a lot of experience with that. I think that's, for me, that decision hasn't been like, well, if they're all different, then it's art. It's more like, as my creative practice does not easily allow me to replicate something. If I'm making something again, I'm going to improve on whatever I learned the first time. Naturally, my instincts are going to take me. Maybe it goes in a different color direction. Maybe I didn't quite like how I did the pattern the last time, and so I'm tweaking it now. So from that perspective, like, everything I make is one of a kind. I've done other smaller batches of things that aren't, but I don't have as much energy for that as, and honestly, on some level, I envy people who do have the discipline to do that, because in a lot of ways, it's so much more profitable. And, that is an absolutely necessary part of being a maker. If you're like doing this in any kind of full-time way, you have to consider the value of what you're making and how profitable it is. And so the farther I get into this and the longer I've been doing this full-time, the way I see the value of what I make has changed. Because at the end of the day, like, the way I have things structured right now, like, what I make has to take care of me. And slapping a label on it and being like, well, I only make art for galleries. Well, I've done galleries, I've showed in galleries, and that doesn't pay my bills in the same way that working with a customer one-on-one to make a commission does. And so I prioritize the work that pays. And maybe like an art collector would look in and be like, well, that isn't valued in the same way, but that's not my goal in this anymore. I will say, it was at the beginning, I had this whole like utopian vision of like, well, I'm gonna get represented and then I'm gonna show in galleries and it's gonna be great. And the reality is that most galleries take 50% and don't do as much promotion as you would hope they would for that, like, you know, that 50%. So, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's all a balance. And so I'm definitely like, my views on all of this have shifted the longer I've been doing it.
This spring equinox, March 17th through 19th, we will gather from all over the world to create a really special place. One where we can expand our skills as makers and learn rituals to help restore our bodies, minds, and souls. Join us for the very first ritual retreat, including 9+ creative care workshops from an amazing lineup of instructors, community, and more. Become a member of our monthly crafting club for makers, Bright Collective, and receive 40% off your ritual ticket. And we have a special 10% discount on Bright Collective yearly memberships for podcast listeners. Use discount code MAKINGCOMBO10. Visit makingzine.com to learn more.
Part of that decentralization is that artists are now able to take a bit more of the control back themselves. And we see this, you know, in the ability to create online businesses and promote yourself and market yourself in ways that you probably couldn't before, whether you're a painter or you're a weaver or whatever. And the other way that we're obviously seeing it, no matter what your feelings on it, is in the NFT space too, in how, you know, that very much is decentralized and taking power out of these systems, you know, say galleries and whatnot. And it's interesting because just as you're sharing that kind of aspect of how you might have seen it before and you placed value on what you were maybe taught or what is seen as success or that stamp of the artist being represented or shown in galleries and selling, you know, a piece or two for a lot versus having more control. And of course, there's so much that comes with that, right? Like running your own business is a whole thing, but you're able to make it profitable. And so like distilling it down to what you just shared about, ultimately it needs to take care of you. And, you know, that whole cliche phrase of like the starving artist, like maybe the starving artist is like a thing of the past and it's like the thriving artist now, because the power is no longer in these places that siphoned or extracted, but rather we're taking it back and we're still figuring it out. We're still figuring out the best way. I mean, obviously there's a lot of noise, so it's hard to figure out how to be seen. And I think maybe that's what we're going to see a big disruption in maybe the next, you know, two decades.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, we, in all of the noise, at least we're getting this understanding of there are a million ways to make this work and to make it work as an artist, whether you do it for a living or not. Like there's so many choices and that can be really overwhelming. But at the end of the day, the individual artist gets to decide what that's going to look like.
I love talking about this, by the way. I think that one of the purposes of this podcast is to help people see more. Because I think when you're on Instagram, when you're on Pinterest, when you're on Google, you know, a lot of that is determined by algorithm. It's determined by things you're already looking at. But what really it is it's showing you the things that most people are looking at. The podcast is different because it's this auditory medium. Like people are putting their earbuds in, listening, going and doing something, but they're digesting content in like a slower way. And on some of these platforms, especially if they're like controversial topics or things that aren't going to get traction, that aren't going to be seen, people aren't going to hear them. They're not going to, unless somehow it was brought into their, you know, sphere of attention, they're not going to be aware or like dig deeper. And I think this conversation about art and craft is really important because I don't really know fully how I feel about this aspect of it yet, but you know, I consider myself an artist. Like I paint, I draw, I, you know, have been a graphic artist for 15 years. I do every craft, all these things. And I think what I have found as I've become like more and more of an artist, you know, like diving deeper into this practice is that there definitely is these things in my mind, in my belief system that devalue certain things I see based on aesthetic, based on quality. And the thing about this last year of just being like on the app, it's different. We don't have an algorithm that we're like funneling content how you do like on Instagram or Pinterest. And on Instagram, you know, I had the algorithm trained. Like I only see like visually, aesthetically pleasing things to me, like things that are very fine and minute around like my taste. And on the Making app, I see a lot of things that are not my taste, that aren't my style, that are made with different materials and qualities. And when I see these things, over the last year, I look at it and I actually start thinking about that person that made that thing and how the feeling that they got from that. And, you know, I'm generalizing here, but like most, I would say a majority of makers, artists, that thing that they made, they hold the same sense of pride They hold the same sense of self-expression. They invested in that the same energy, whether it's in the form of money or heart space or mind or time, that I did in what I made. And so for me to assign this value of it, of like art versus not art, you know, like if I see something that, you know, I would deem shitty, you know, and but then like I see mine and I don't feel that way, like that's me assigning value on something. And I think I mentioned earlier that this is problematic for so many reasons, and we get to decide whether we like it or not, but we don't get to decide whether it's art or not. And, you know, that really to me is where this all lies. And it's something that I'm constantly like retraining my brain, that it might not be my taste, but it doesn't mean that it's not art.
Yeah, that is so true. It's like when we're only looking at art within the context of like, you know, Instagram and Pinterest, the value of it is in the metrics. It's like, how many people are getting to see this? How many followers do these artists have? How much money are they making it? And that is such a limited way to see and to value artwork. And yeah, I mean, that's like one thing that's attractive to me and like keeps me like hopping on the making app is it feels so much more human. And you're right. It's like you see something and it's like, it's not even about the aesthetic or the actual object that somebody made. It's like, oh, here's an actual human who lives somewhere in the world and they were so proud of this thing that they wanted to like post it and share it. And that is just so much more energizing to like scroll through that kind of feed rather than the opposite, where it's like that puts us constantly into like comparison with these other people, because it's like, oh yeah, like I have the things aesthetically that I like showing up, but then I'm like, oh, is that recent piece that I made, is that on par with these? And then I'm getting in my head about it and it's like sucking all of my creative energy. Ugh. Yeah.
There's this show on Netflix called Magic for Humans, and my kids have been watching it, and it's this guy named Justin Willman, I think is his name. Anyways, he does incredible magic. Like I'm so blown away, and it's all live in person, like on the streets of LA. And what's unique about this show is he really weaves in these kind of topics that like what we're talking about, which is these underlying issues or things that we should be thinking about. And he did an episode that I saw the other night that was all about like influencers. And so he brought these three influencers in from, I don't know, YouTube, other platforms. And he had pre-planted essentially kind of little like cues and around like several different things. You can't tell that like when you start watching this. And so these three influencers come in and he's like talking to them and he gives them an assignment. And it's like, they're in this, I can't remember, but they're in this space that has like all these different backgrounds you can take pictures on and different rooms and stuff like that. And he says, you need to pick an object and a something, something, a something, something. And I want you each to make a post. And so they all go do this individually, not together. And then he has them come back in the room and he has them post at the exact same time. They pick one photo out of the many they took out of many different rooms and objects and post it with a phrase. And all three of them picked the same room, the same object, and the same phrase. And his question to them before revealing this was, as influencers, do you think it's harder for you to be influenced? And they said, of course, like we're not easily influenced. And then he revealed this and he said, okay, like show each other the post that you did. And they were stunned, speechless. And it wasn't a magic trick, you know, it was like really psychology and showing how it's so imperceptible how we are influenced and how we are original and like how we, what we think is original. And where I'm going with this is they're just subtle cues, whether they're intentional or not, whether it's just the fact that we're all exposed to the same nature and world and experiences, to things that are intentional and the things that are controlled in the platforms we're seeing and the things we're seeing, we are in a silos and we don't realize it. And, you know, this is kind of a theme, like I've talked about this in other episodes, but when it comes to art, I think it's really important for us as makers to seek out originality, to seek out being unique. And that isn't something you have to necessarily try and figure out. What you have to do is create space for that, especially with things like AI. You know, the thing that AI can't replicate is true uniqueness. But if we spend all of our time looking at what others are making and seeking out the same inspiration and resources, it's less unique, you know, like it's still unique, it still holds value, but we really need to be inspired by each other, but go within. Again, this is just one of those things. We all want to imitate each other. We all want to be like each other in some ways, but I think it's our responsibility as we're unpacking all these things to seriously think about going more within as opposed to looking on the outside and how we express ourselves through art.
You know how those like AI bots like search the internet and like when they make something, they're like taking pieces from all over. It's almost like that's what we're doing, except we're just doing it much more slowly and inefficiently because we're not robots. But yeah, I would love to see like a study on that and how we're coming up with things creatively. Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. I mean, that's why, I mean, that's like a whole other thing, but the whole like copying conversation, I just think a lot of times people don't even realize they're doing it. Because you're just taking in so much information all day long and you never know what's going to come out. But yeah, we need to like look inside, look at outside of our phones for inspiration. That's for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for having this conversation with me. I know I get like super philosophical and intense about it, but it gets me excited to talk about these kind of things, especially being in tech and building, you know, a technological product and how my response, what is my responsibility on impact of people? And I really take that seriously and I don't even fully understand it, but it's something that I'm trying to be really cognizant of, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like when I first heard of the Making app, I think it like came up on my TikTok. My initial thought was like, oh, not another thing. And eventually I saw enough TikToks where I was like, all right, I'm just going to download it and look at it. And it's just, it's clearly different than anything else that's happening that's remotely similar. And, it's just, it's filling an important gap that I think we didn't know we needed. Like I don't know. I've just been living in Instagram land for like years and have become so disconnected from what I make. And like I've had serious seasons of like everything I'm making is like to post it. Like that's the eventual context surrounding what I'm doing. And that takes so much out of the creative process and it feels so inauthentic, and then your numbers dip and it's like, yeah. I mean, when, yeah, they just control everything without you even intending to. And oh God. But yeah, I don't know. So with circular weaving, I have tried to be really intentional with where I'm finding my inspiration. And this kind of happened without even realizing it. But I started like posting my work in like a serious way in like 2015, 2016. And very quickly started noticing similar things that weren't there before popping up. And so I got really like precious about my process because I didn't want anybody to copy me. But circular weaving has just increased in popularity. And I saw that happening and was like, how do I do something different? And anyway, looking back, I can see how much research has like helped me kind of differentiate what I'm doing from the crowd. At least that's what I hope. And doing research like outside of internet, because for one, there is very little until the last few years, there's been very little like weaving information online, period, without joining like, you know, a guild or some sort of association that has like private articles or whatever. And yeah, but how that's going to work for everybody is going to be different. Research lights me up. I've been fortunate to find myself in libraries that have great like textile, sections. But yeah, I think what you bring up is really important about like where we're finding that inspiration.
So shifting gears a little bit, let's talk about your book. Because it's a big deal this year. This was a big year for you. And so tell me a little bit about the story of that book. How did it come to be? And, you just finished a little mini tour here in the States. So yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah. So I have been pretty much exclusively weaving circles since 2016, and it was just something I really enjoyed. And like I was saying before, it was like I got really into research and trying to discover what was possible for this like round format. Because when I came into it, okay, originally I was just trying to weave radial shapes. I was weaving like arches and ovals, and that eventually led me to picking up an embroidery hoop one day and being like turning it into a loom and weaving my first circle. But it was something I just continued doing. Teaching had become a really big part of my practice, and because I had these students who were asking me for something new and different, I felt this pull to find things that were new and different. And so when a publishing company approached me and told me they were looking for somebody to write a book on circular weaving, I was ready to do it. And I had never intended for this to be a book, or never even thought I would have enough information to write a whole book. That's like a big comment I get. People are like, really? There's like enough on such a niche subject for there to be an entire book? And honestly, I'm as surprised as other people are. Yeah, so that's how it came to be. It had just gained in popularity, and there hadn't been a book on the topic devoted to the topic. And so my publishing company was looking for somebody to write it. Yeah, so I was first approached about the book at the end of 2020, and I said yes. And so I put together a proposal, and then they were like, okay, we're going to review it and we'll get back to you. And so I didn't hear anything for a few months. And during that time, that's when my husband and I decided we would move to Cyprus. And so 2 weeks before we moved, I got an email that the book was like got picked up and they sent me a contract. And I was like, oh my God, this is so exciting. And also, where am I going to write this book? How am I going to get materials? All of that. So then 2 weeks we moved to Cyprus. I'm like, no, I'm writing this book and don't know how any of it's going to happen. But at some point, my grandfather has passed away, but the last like 30 years or so of his life, he worked out of this office that he built in my grandparents' garden at their house. And since he passed, it had been sitting empty. And so at some point my uncle said, oh, Emily, like you should take the office and like turn it into a studio. And so that's what I did. And so when we moved, I got here, I renovated this office, and that's where I ended up writing the book. And so I had a lot of help from family because no one had gone through anything that my grandfather had left, and it was all exactly as he left it. So we like went through it, family, friends, cousins, things like people like that actually helped me renovate the space. And then by the end of August 2021, I was like starting to write my book. And yeah, so that really like occupied my first 9 months living here was the getting the studio together and then the actual writing process. And so it's kind of all a blur at this point. I like didn't really do or think about anything else for that whole time. But now that the book is out, it's like such a, I don't know. I mean, first off, I couldn't tell anybody about it. And had this like big secret project and didn't really have time to like make anything else, or I wasn't like teaching at that point either. So now that it's out, it's like, oh, all right, now it's out there in the world and I can like let it go and like see who ends up with the book and what they make from it. And that is such a good feeling.
I bet, for sure. So what's on the horizon for you? What are you excited about these days?
Holiday season where I don't have looming deadlines right up until the new year. So I am ecstatic. And also my body is like, what is going on? Usually this is like my rush time, and I get to like sit back and make cookies and read books and do my shopping at my own leisure. And so that's different. So I'm really excited about that. But yeah, in the new year, I'm getting ready to do a bunch of custom work for some private collectors and some corporate. I have a corporate contract. And so I'm excited to just get back into it in the new year and actually be in making mode again. I'm very much somebody who does things one at a time. I don't tend to balance a bunch of projects at the same time very well. And so when I wrote the book, I like just wrote the book, and then I kind of did some other things. And now the book is out. I did my mini tour, went to the US, taught workshops. And in the new year, at least the first 6 months, I get to just make work. And so I'm so excited to focus on that again, because it's been a while since I got to do that.
If you had a message for the world, what would it be?
I would say that everyone is meant for creativity in some way. And it may not look like making art or making a physical object, but we all get to engage in creativity in one way or another. And I would encourage people to make time for that, whatever that is, whether it's cooking or dancing or curating playlists or making new technology. Like, it's all creative, and that's what makes us human.
Biggest of thanks to Bright Collective members. You directly support the development of the Making app, production of this podcast, and everything else we do here at Making. We're so full of gratitude and can't wait to share everything 2023 has to offer. I hope you'll join me each week as we talk and learn from more fascinating makers. For podcast notes and transcriptions, visit our blog at makingzine.com. Have a wonderful week.